Thank you very much. My name is Mark, and I am from Johns Hopkins University working with Professor Emanuele Berti. So today I'm going to talk to you about black hole ringdowns. And I hope that by the end of this talk, you'll find black hole ringdown to be a fascinating subject, because even if you disregard all the theory and the physics, you'll find that this is a very interesting data analysis or a very interesting modeling problem. Okay? Now, so when we talk about black hole ringdown, we're talking about gravitational waves, right? So when two black holes merge, they merge like this, and then they will emit gravitational waves, right? And then if you look at one of the gravitational waves, it looks like this. And it consists of like an in spiral phase, a merger phase, and a ring down phase. So this peak strain of the waveform, it corresponds to when the two black holes are merging together. And then in the end, it will turn into the ring down phase. And today I'll only be talking about this phase, okay? So at the end of the space-time evolution, it will approach a stationary Kerr black hole. And at the later and later stage, it will approach the Kerr space-time more and more. So we can model these gravitation waves as perturbations on top of a Kerr space-time, at least for late times, okay? So that is called black hole perturbation theory. So usually, if we want to solve a gravitational waveform, we need to solve Einstein's field equations, right? And it's very simple, it looks like this. But then, because we know that the space-time will approach a stationary Kerr space-time, we can write down the metric as an expansion, right? It is a background space-time, the Kerr space-time, plus some perturbation terms that is, the order is defined by this order counting parameter epsilon, which we assume to be small. And then we can solve Einstein field equations order by order, right? If you plug this metric back into the Einstein field equations, and then you collect all the terms of the same order as epsilon, then you can solve Einstein's field equations order by order. There's the first order equation, there's a second order equation. But you can't really do anything when you write it down like this. It's too complicated. So if you use the Neumann-Penrose spin coefficient formula sum, and Tikhovsky, Saul Tikhovsky in 1973 found that you can write these equations in a much simpler form with this Tikhovsky operator. And there's just a linear partial differential equation that is separable. Okay. And the second order Tikhovsky equation is just the first order one, but this time you plug the first order term on the right hand side and you square it, and then you will be able to solve for the second order solution. So this is effectively the perturbations on top of this Kerr space time, and you can convert this back into gravitational waves and you can solve the problem. Okay? So what does this Tikhovsky operator look like? It's pretty long. But if you take the Schwarzschild limit, then you get a nice equation that looks like the Schrodinger equation. There's a potential in this equation, and there's also a frequency, right? And this is like the perturbation term that you can convert back into gravitational waves. The potential looks like this. And if you want to solve this problem, then it's a boundary fellow problem, because you can impose that at the horizon, which is negative infinity, the waves should be ingoing. And then at the infinity, there should not be waves that are coming in, right? And then you can solve this boundary fellow problem, and you can solve for the frequencies omega given an ansatz, okay? So if you put boundary conditions, you'll find the solutions of this equation and you'll find quasi-normal modes. So the quasi-normal modes, they look like this. So firstly, there is each of these quasi-normal modes are labeled by this LMN, which are the mode numbers. So it's just like solving the Schrodinger equation for a hydrogen atom, right? They are the LM spherical harmonics. And in each of these harmonics, there are different solutions that we label by the number N, okay? Now, you can see that here this quasi-normal mode is just like a normal mode. However, this frequency, so there's the amplitude, the phase, and the frequency. Right. But then this frequency is actually complex. Okay, if you break this complex frequency down into imaginary and the real part, you can see that the imaginary part is actually a modulation to an oscillation term. So the real term is like an oscillation, and the imaginary part is an exponential. It's either growing exponential or decaying exponential. But then you will find that for most black hole spacetimes, unless it's extremal Kerr, you find that all the modes, they actually decaying, okay? So meaning that the imaginary part of the frequency is actually negative. Okay. So if I plot one of these quasi-normal modes, they will look like this. It's just a damped oscillation, right? So you see that it's an oscillation modulated by an exponentially decaying term. And normally, we actually plot this in log scale, and we take also the absolute value. So it looks like this. It like this straight line here is exponential decay, and then the bumps are the oscillations, OK? Now, if we solve the Tarkovsky equations for the omegas, the omega LMNs, then you'll find that you can plot the solutions in the complex plane, of course, because they are complex numbers. And all of the solutions have an imaginary part that is negative. Okay? So here, I plotted the 220, 221, and 222 modes. And this 220 correspond to LMN. So L equals M equals 2, and then N equals 0. So this, the so-called fundamental mode of the LM equals 22 spherical harmonic. And then there's also the first overtone, 221, and then the second overtone, 222. And in most binary black hole simulations, we will find that the 220 mode is actually dominant. Okay? And here, perhaps you can already see why we are calling this black hole ring down, right? Because if you have a bell and you use a huge hammer and you strike the bell, right? Then you'll hear a spectrum, right? You will hear like a fundamental mode, an overtone, and then even higher overtones. And that is why you know that it's a bell, because you hear all these frequencies mixed together, right? And the same goes for black holes, right? If you strike a black hole or if you shoot two black holes together, then you'll hear that it oscillates at characteristic frequencies. And that's why you know that it's a black hole that is ringing. Oh, so that is why we call it black hole ring down. Now, this mode is usually dominant in binary black hole mergers, at least for non-precessing ones. And then there are also other modes that are subdominant. There could be a 210 mode, 330 mode, 440 mode. These correspond to the modes you solve from like the other spherical harmonics. And if you plot all of the modes that could ever exist in the black hole, then you see like a lot of different modes. Okay. Now, like a very natural question comes, right? Like, which of these modes are excited and to what degree, right? And this is one of the questions we try to answer in this talk. Okay. So this program of measuring the frequencies and testing whether the object is a black hole is called black hole spectroscopy, because like regular spectroscopy, you look at the emission or absorption lines of a gas, and then you know that the gas exists, right? So in black hole spectroscopy, you measure the frequencies, and then so you know that a black hole is there, right? Yeah?
What sets which mode is the dominant?
So it's the initial conditions. It's not related to the potential. It's related to the initial conditions of the perturbation. Yeah, so what initial conditions you put for the perturbation, how it evolves. Like the frequencies are defined by the potential, but the amplitudes are defined by the initial conditions. So I claim that black hole spectroscopy is actually pretty simple, right? Because the quasi-normal modes, they have a pretty simple form. You can write this down on a piece of paper, and that's the gravitational wave waveform, right? And if you want to know the full gravitational waveform, you have to do a lot of things in PN theory and also in NR, right? And the quasi-normal frequencies, omegas, themselves are actually pretty simple because they are only a function of the remnant mass and the spin. And that is actually promised by No-Hare theorem, right? Like if we ignore the charge, okay? Because any observable of the black hole, like if it's only one black hole, right? It should only be a function of the remnant mass and the remnant spin, okay? And these are independent of the initial conditions, as I just mentioned. So whatever happens before the merger, if the remnant has this mass and this spin, then I can tell you it has this, and certain frequency. Okay. And these omegas, they are also relatively easy to calculate. You can do it like semi-analytically and on a laptop. You don't need NR. Okay. So that's my claim. Black hole spectroscopy is relatively simple. And black hole spectroscopy is also pretty powerful because it actually provides smoking gun evidence of a black hole if you measured some of these frequencies. So this is a quote by Detweiler. The observation of the black hole's resonant frequencies might finally provide direct evidence of black holes with the same certainty as, say, the 21 cm line identifies interstellar hydrogen, right? Because only when it is a black hole, it will emit like a certain spectrum of frequencies. So if you see this spectrum of frequencies, you know it's a black hole. And then you can use the observed frequency to test GR and also to test the no-Hell theorem, because you know that the frequencies has to only depend on mass and spin. If there is an additional parameter that you need to include in your model, then perhaps GR or the no-Hell theorem is wrong. Okay? And also, you can potentially probe the environment surrounding a black hole, because if, for example, there's a dark matter spike outside of the black hole, the frequencies will be different, right? So the story is simply to calculate the frequencies in theory and see if you also observe those frequencies and whether there are deviations. Yeah?
Why do you have a spin dependence in the frequency if you were in the non-rotating
situation? No, if it's non-rotating, then the spin is zero. So it only depends on the mass. Yeah, but here I'm talking about the general case when there is spin. Yeah. Okay, but this requires a detection of at least two modes, because if you only detected one mode, you can always map, because one mode is like a real and imaginary part, right? So these are two real numbers. You can always map them back into the mass and spin. Okay, so if you detect one mode, it's always degenerate. But if you detect two modes, then you can see whether there are deviations. Okay, so in fact, we have already detected quasi-normal modes. In LIGO and Virgo, they detected a lot of gravitational wave events. And I believe in all, if not most of them, they confidently identified one quasi-normal mode. And the case for multimode detection is way more interesting, because we need to see two modes before we can test GR, right? And this is actually studied actively. There are detection claims of the 2-to-1 overtone, and also there are claims of the 330, 210, 320. So today, I won't be addressing the data analysis part of black hole ring down. I'll only talk about the modeling, and also I'll only be looking at like NR simulations. But actually, people here have also done work on this. This is Sijeng, so you can talk to him, and you also talk to me about my opinions on this. Okay. This is kind of a thorny subject, to be honest. Okay. So how do we identify ring down modes in, for example, a waveform, right? Like if I give you this, right? Can you tell me which modes are present in the ring down, right? I can definitely see one mode here, the dominant one. But then the subdominant ones can have an amplitude that is very, very small. So how can we identify them, right? But first, we need to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Like what do we mean by a mode being present in the waveform, right? So let's discuss this, okay? How about we say a mode being present means that if you include that mode in your model, then it fits the waveform better, right? So for example, we can do something like this. We say, okay, some modes are expected to be there, okay? For example, if we are talking about the waveform extracted on the spherical harmonic LM equals 2-2, then we should expect the fundamental 2-2-0 mode to be there, and also the overtones, right? Because they should be excited, like no matter how small the degree is, right? How small the amplitude is, right? So let's say we assume that these modes are there, and then we include all of them in our model, and we see if these modes fit the ring down waveform well. And if it does, then perhaps the modes are actually there, right? Let's see what happens if we do that. So this is not something that I did. This is a paper by Gisler et al. In 2019. And so the way to read this plot is by seeing that the x-axis here is the starting time of the fit. So they are doing a lot of different fits of the gravitational wave waveform, starting at the peak of the waveform strain, and then they are going later and later and later, and they are doing a fit at each time, okay? And then they found that if you include only one fundamental mode, then you can see that at a later and later time, your fit is actually performing better and better. So this mismatch is just a goodness of fit parameter. So this is like the loss, like the least squares loss of your fit, okay, something like that. So if you go later and later, your fundamental mode actually fits better. And that's expected, right? Because at a later and later time, the overtones will have decayed, and also your space-time is approaching the current space-time, right? Okay, great. And then they found that if you include both the fundamental mode and the first overtone, so the n equals 1 model, they found that you can fit the waveform well at a much earlier time, and also the goodness of fit actually improves a lot. Okay, So perhaps the first overtone is there. They add another overtone, this time the second overtone, so they are using 1, 2, 3 modes, and they get this curve, even better. And then they add more and more overtones, even better and better and better. And in the end, when they are using all 7 overtones, so 8 modes in their model, they find that the goodness of fit is almost at the level of the noise of the NR simulation. Okay? And then they found that they can start the fit close to the merger peak. Okay? And that's really surprising because this is linear perturbation theory, but then they successfully applied it to the peak of the merger. Okay? So this is surprising to say the least. And in fact, the stance of my group is that there are some potential issues in this strategy. Because firstly, like just looking at the results and then think of the intuition from physics, right? Nonlinearities are expected. Gravitational wave events like binary black hole mergers, they are very violent, right? So I would expect that at the peak of the strain, there should be a lot of nonlinearities. So why could linear perturbation work so well? Secondly, even if you believe that there are no nonlinearities, the background space-time is actually evolving. It's not a stationary black hole when the two black holes just merged, right? The spin and the mass are still evolving at the percent level. And if you are using results from linear perturbation theory where you assume that the background is a stationary curved black hole, maybe something will be wrong. At least the frequencies will be evolving, right? The quasi-normal frequencies. Now, if you think about the fitting, right, the procedure, right? Like we found that if we include more and more overtones, the fit becomes better. But then for each overtone you introduce, we are leaving the amplitude and the phase of that mode free when we are fitting, right? So you're including more and more parameters. So there's a higher risk of overfitting. And in the end, I think this is the most important. Overtones, they decay very rapidly, right? So here on the right-hand side, I plotted each of the quasi-normal frequencies that I was just showing. Each of them normalized to an amplitude of 1. And you can see that the fundamental mode, you can see a nice sinusoidal oscillation and a decay, right? Great. For the first overtone, you still see kind of a decay and also a oscillation, right? But then when you go to higher and higher overtones, for example, look at 5, 6, and 7, you don't really see the oscillation anymore. So these are effectively exponential decays without oscillation if you're talking about nonlinear least squares, right? Because only the early part of your fit will matter for nonlinear least squares. Yeah.
Can you go to the previous figure? Because if I understand you correctly,
yeah.
The higher the opportunities, they get even faster and faster. Like
Yeah.
If you see at late time a huge difference, so does this mean that initially they have to have also very large amplitude?
So at the late time, their amplitudes are actually different. Yeah, like because they, at different times, they are doing a different set of fits with different sets of amplitudes. So you will see that later. I will talk about this. Yeah. So here, the overtones, they are actually having a very high amplitude and they're fitting the noise in our opinion. Okay. So that's a great point. We'll talk about this later. Okay, so given the caveats, right, let's try to perform some additional tests to see whether we can see the overtones, okay? So firstly, let us test whether the quasi-normal frequencies that we were using were actually necessary for the model to perform well, okay? So for example, let's focus on the 220 fundamental mode. Is this frequency really important, or can we just use any random frequency in order to perform well? Okay. So here the black curve is the mismatch, so just like the plot I showed you before, with the model with all 8 modes. Okay. Now let's try to do this. Let's try to substitute the 220 fundamental mode with one of the blue circles here. So these blue circles are sampled from a distribution from 0 to 2 times the original 220 complex frequency. So both the imaginary part and real part can vary by 2 times. And then we substitute this blue circle with the original mode and see whether the mismatch will change. Okay? So we do a fit with all of these blue circles, and we find that the mismatch deteriorates. Okay? It actually becomes much worse if you use these random frequencies. And that makes a lot of sense because we know that the 220 is a dominant mode. It exists in the waveform. If we use a random frequency, of course, you're performing worse, right? So if the original frequency fits better than any other random frequency, it supports the existence of that mode. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is the fundamental mode, right? What if we do the same thing, but this time for the first overtone, we substitute it with a frequency that we sample from 0 to 2 times, the original one. And then we can also perform the same thing for the second overtone, just like this, and also, of course, the third one, fourth one, the fifth one, right? Then you will find that the mismatch, if you randomize the first overtone frequency, it becomes a little worse, yes. So perhaps first overtone is dead. Now the second one, it only performs worse, like the random frequencies only perform worse when the like close to the merger peak, right? This is like around 5 amps. So from 0 to 5 amps, the original frequency performs better than the random ones, right? You go to here, there's not really too much of a disconnection anymore. And if you go to the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th overtone, the random frequencies are performing just as well. And here we are randomizing the frequencies a lot. It's 0 to 2 times. So it means that even a wildly different frequency can overfit the merger to the same degree of wellness of fit.
What's the difference between this, the two colors?
Oh, yeah. So for, yes. For the solid color, we are only randomizing, for example here, we're only randomizing the first overtone, but not all the other ones. But for the dimmer color, we are randomizing everything above the first overtone. Okay, so this seems to see that perhaps there is some overfitting with this model for the overtone higher than 4. Okay. Now, for the next test, right? Just now you asked about the amplitude, right? So perhaps we can check whether the fitted mode amplitude is a constant. Because if you look at a quasi-normal mode, these are 4 real numbers. Amplitude, phase, imaginary, and real part of the frequency. And they are all constants in time by definition. Okay? You solve the Cauchy equation, you find that they are constants in time. And so we can check whether this is actually the case, right? Okay, for example, right? If we perform the fit later and later, so at each instance of time, we perform a different set of fit. So basically, we're changing the time window for our fit. We're changing the starting time of the fit. Okay, then you'll find that if we include only one mode in our model, then the amplitude of that mode, the fundamental mode, will be evolving from the beginning to the end. But at the end, you see that it approaches a flat line, right? So that's good news, because it means that the amplitude of that fundamental mode is constant. Great, right? So after t equals 10m, of course, we're using geometrical units. So time has the unit of the remnant mass. So after that, the fundamental mode is a flat, right? This model is a flat mode, it's a consistent model. Now, what if we include also the first overtone in our model? So this time you see that the fundamental mode is almost always flat. The first overtone is kind of flat in between, but then it blows up in the end. So the blowing up, I believe, is because it is trying to pick up the noise. Because as you can see here, we're always extrapolating the amplitude back to the peak when we're making this plot, right? So if the overtone tries to fit away the noise here, and the noise has like a constant level, then if you extrapolate it back, then this will blow up. Okay, so it's expected to blow up in the end. But at the very least, in the intermediate regime, we see that there is a region where, for example, like between 10m and 25m, where the first overtone is constant. So great, perhaps the overtone is also there. What if we do this for all of the other overtones? Right? So this is a fit with only fundamental mode. This is fundamental mode plus first overtone. This is fundamental mode, first overtone, second overtone. So on and so forth. Okay. The highlighted region is the region we call it flat. So we use a tolerance, something like 10% variation in the amplitude. And by the way, be careful, because here the axis is different. Okay. So here we are zooming in close to the merger. And you can see that the second overtone, when we use a model with only 0, 1, and 2, the second overtone amplitude actually varies quite a bit. And if you want to call this flat, sure. But it's only flat for like 5 to 6m. And for reference, the period of these quasi-normal modes, they are around 15-ish, 16-ish m. So here we are finding that these amplitudes, they are not stable even for half a period. So can you really say that the overlap is there when it doesn't consistently exist for a full period? In my opinion, we couldn't. Okay. So if you go to higher overtones, you see that this, firstly, you see that the amplitudes are not really flat at all. This is log scale, by the way. And the region of flatness, if you insist on calling it flat, it's shrinking more and more. Okay. So perhaps we're overfitting with the overtones.
Why is there a depth? Why is there a depth?
I am not sure. Because what we're fitting are like quasi-normal modes, and there are dips and periods. Maybe that is why. Like there are oscillations in the waveform.
This is the initial amplitude, right?
This is the initial amplitude, but then when you go later and later, only the later parts matter. Right?
So I have a system that's picking up the noise later. Did you look at different resolutions and see if you got like a flat curve or longer?
Oh, yes. It doesn't really change much if we use different resolutions in the SXS simulations. By the way, there's like a simulation from the SXS catalog. Yeah. It doesn't change the conclusions. The flatness doesn't improve too much. But we did some toy models, injections, where we put a noise level and then we try to increase it. And when the noise level increases, then the blow up happens earlier.
So do you think it's some different quote unquote noise than just truncation errors?
Truncation
errors? I don't know, something else.
Maybe. Yes, you're right. Maybe I think the dominant contamination here is actually mode mixing, which I'll talk about later. But also the tail or numerical noise could play a part.
So there is a question from Eric online.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eric?
Hello, my name's Eric. You're trying to match these modes, and at later times, they differ in amplitude by two orders of magnitude. What hope do you have realistically to actually determine the higher order modes? Shouldn't you say once the higher order mode is lower than, say, one or two orders of magnitude, you should stop completely finding them, because you'd need an incredible accuracy to actually find them in the data?
Yes. So we like our suggestion is to not use the higher overtones for doing tests of GR, because not only do the amplitudes vary a lot, but also the frequency. If you look at the best fit frequency, the higher overtones, they actually vary a lot, and so you can't really test GR with them. Like the first overtone maybe, but the higher ones not really. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I was actually starting much earlier. You just plot the first few modes on top of each other. And once you have a base mode, and the higher mode is, once it's smaller than the base mode by one or two orders of magnitude, there is, I think, essentially no point in looking for them. I mean, you don't even need to try looking for it, because there's only noise. Here, for example, at t equals 20, on the right graph, it doesn't make sense to even look for the smaller mode. Whatever you're finding, it's going to be noise.
Yeah, but so current claims of overtone detection, they are starting at the peak of the waveform. So at that time, the overtones are still, they have a pretty high amplitude. But our suggestion is not to start that early. But if you could start that early, then perhaps it will be useful. But you're right. If you go very late, then the amplitudes are hopelessly low already. Yeah. Okay. So some lessons. Right? Some lessons. So the many overtones model fits the data well, but might not be physical. Right. There might be some overfitting happening, at least for the model that we're using. Right. And perhaps we need some more stringent criteria to determine whether the modes are actually there, right? And there are also some questions, right? Like, so we did not see the overtones, right? But does this mean that the overtones are not there? Or does that mean that there's some problem with our model? For example, we didn't include some subdominant contaminations in our model? Or perhaps the overtones, they just have a too low an amplitude to be seen, right? It doesn't mean that the overtones are not excited at all. But later, I will give you a hypothesis, right? One of my speculations. So yes, there's something called the spectral instability of the overtones, and that could cause the overtones to be not there, but I'll talk about that later. And also, is the ring down fully linear? And the answer is a resounding no, because we found nonlinear quasi-normal modes, and that is something I'll be talking about later. Yeah. Okay, but first for an interlude, okay? Instability of the black hole spectrum. So let's try to see whether the whole black hole spectroscopy program of computing quasi-normal modes is stable against perturbations. So this is something like the perturbation of the perturbation theory itself, because we are changing the background space-time just a tiny bit, okay? We include, for example, this is the potential for a squashy black hole, right? This is the angular momentum barrier, and we solve the boundary problem with this potential. What if we add a very tiny but high frequency perturbation component to this potential? What will happen? Then Jaramillo et al, they actually found that even if the perturbation is very tiny, like 10 to the negative 8, right? They found that the clean spectrum are the red points, but the perturbed spectrum are the blue ones. The fundamental mode is okay, it's the same as before, even after the perturbation. But then if you go to higher and higher overtones, there's a larger and larger deviation, okay? Now there's a caveat here, because what we mean by small and big, actually it's determined by the norm, and actually Juan has a paper that discussed this very nicely. You can look right there. And these offers, they are actually using the so-called energy norm. So these perturbations are small in the sense that something like the energy of that perturbation is small, okay? But still, like in the real world, these perturbations could happen. And if that is the case, given that the wavelength of this perturbation is short, then the spectrum will deviate a lot from the clean one, okay? This is actually related to the non-self-adjoint nature of the problem. Okay. Now, this has actually been observed a long time ago already by Fischbacher-Schwaller in 1996. That interestingly, we find that the fundamental mode is in general insensitive to small changes in the potential, whereas the higher modes could alter drastically. Okay, so that was what Jaramillo found. But is the fundamental mode really insensitive to small perturbations? Let us try to do this. Let us, this time, add a small bump. Okay. The theorists in the audience might already think that perhaps here, then there will be something happening in this valley, right? Because these modes could live inside this valley, right? So, and that's in fact the case. The fundamental mode is also unstable. Now, if on the potential, we put a very tiny bump. This bump looks big, but it's not to scale. There's actually 10 to the negative 7 of this bigger bump. If you put this bump further and further away, you see that the fundamental mode, it actually moves quite a lot, right? The height of the bump is 10 to the negative 7, but then the frequency can evolve by order like 0.1, okay? And you can see that there are also a lot of other modes that are coming from above. These are actually the overtones that are coming down, and these are actually the trapped modes between the two barriers. Okay. So even the fundamental mode is actually unstable. Okay. This is a work that I put out a year or two ago. However, do we have to worry, right? Like if this is like unstable spectrum, then do we expect to observe the clean spectrum in actual data analysis, right? We don't have to worry about the fundamental mode instability, because if we do a time evolution of the same problem with like the small bump added, you will find that the dirty spectrum is only observed at a later time, but at an earlier time, the ring down still follows the same clean spectrum. Okay, so don't have to worry about the spectral instability of the fundamental mode. What about the overtones? So the same people, Jaramillo et al, they look at the overtones in the time domain evolution of the perturbation, and they found that the the overtones actually follow the dirty spectrum, the perturbed spectrum, the unstable spectrum, close to the peak. Okay, so perhaps this overtone instability could alter the time domain response. Maybe that is why we didn't see the overtones. But this is highly speculative, and there's a lot of work to be done here.
Okay. Sorry, can you say that again? Mm-hmm. So they add small perturbation, the same kind of perturbations that you guys did, or?
They added the high frequency perturbations, yes.
And then you're saying the overtone frequencies change a lot?
Yes. Yes, it follows
the time domain, the overtone signal.
Yes.
No matter, like the change of overtone signal.
Yes, yes. So here they subtracted all the other modes, and these are like this is the second overtone that they see in the signal. So I don't know why their overtone is that clean, but looking at this, like the clean signal versus the dirty signal, they are definitely different.
So what is their separation? Because their separation is large enough, you have to follow.
Oh no, it's not the two bump case, it's the high frequency perturbation case. So there are no separations.
Okay.
But
what do you mean by high frequency?
High frequency perturbations means something like this. You should go look at their paper. I'm not sure if this is exactly what they did. I think it's either this or like random perturbations.
Okay.
Sure. Eric?
Eric, please go ahead.
Yes. I might have missed it in the beginning. When you match the modes, what exactly is the matching procedure? You must have some kind of dot product or some kind of norm that you're using. What is that?
You mean when we are fitting the ring down?
Yes.
When I am fitting the ring down, I use nonlinear least squares. So it's basically a least squares fitting problem. When they are fitting the modes, I think they're using Prony method, if I recall.
How does least squares, I mean, you need an integral or something for that. What integral are you using?
It's basically like we have different data points at different times, right? So at each time, we take the square of the deviation of the model with the true waveform, and then we sum all of them. So
are you using any kind of weight when you sum them?
Can you say that again?
Are you using any kind of weights when you sum them?
No, I'm not using weights.
Okay, yeah. But here you have a function that decreases by 10 orders of magnitude, and then you just add them all up. That means you're really only looking at the first few points,
yes.
And the last points have basically no effect. That is a weird procedure. I mean, why would you even say you match the function? Because visually on this log plot, it looks that they're similar, but numerically in your algorithm, you just look at the first few m and everything else could be ignored.
Yeah, so you're right. And actually, we actually also try to reweight the fit by like a log, like an exponential decay. But we found that the results do not improve much. And maybe, I are you saying that like this red curve is trying to fit the blue curve here?
No,
because it's not.
You just said the results don't improve much. I think if you don't use a weight function, the results don't make sense. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you match 0 to 10 or 0 to 50.
Yeah, I
understand. The data points are so very small.
Yes, I understand. But as long as the least squares error is still inside of your loss that you minimize, even though it's small, it will still try to find the correct value. So I understand your concerns. I was very concerned. So I also did a lot of tests that I will show you the paper later, and in the appendices, we have 9 appendices, we did a lot of tests, and we found that the results make sense. Hope that makes you a little more comfortable.
Okay, so if you take a mode and you slightly change the mode at t equals 60, then that should not make any difference to your matching, because that's 10 orders of magnitude below what you're matching.
If you fit the waveform at the peak, then changing something at t equals 60, sure, you won't see any difference. However, what we'll be doing is to fit the waveform at different times, right? From t equals 0, we do a fit, and then t equals 1, t equals 2, until t equals 50. So if something
you mean the starting
between,
time?
No,
the,
yes.
You the mean the starting times?
The starting times, yes. Then if when that is the case, then we can see whether something happens between 0 to 50 that changed our result.
Oh, yes. Yes, I agree. But essentially, you're never trying to fit the whole waveform. Every time you say a fit, you try to fit only, whatever, 10m or something, and everything else could be cut off. So I think you could introduce a stop time, and whether you set the stop time to starting time plus 10 or starting time plus 100, there should be very little difference in the algorithm.
Yes, you are right. That is something we can try.
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
So based on our test, we found the window actually matters.
Okay.
More over modes. Basically, rely on the data part for fundamental mode. Then you somehow take that information back to the peak, so that you can subtract that fundamental mode. Then you can.
Okay. Yeah, but I claim that because we're using the full waveform, we're ending the waveform at like 120m before we see the numerical noise. I claim that although we do not put weights, we still include the information at the later stage.
Right.
Now this is I understand this is a subtle technical point, but if you worry about the procedure, perhaps you can look at the test that we do in the paper.
Yeah.
At least it convinces you that it's working.
Yeah. I don't think it's a technical point. I think you're doing something that is slightly different from what people think you're doing in your matching. Okay, go on. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, we can talk about this later. Yeah. Sure. But I agree. So the point is that there are a lot of different things we can do. As a community, we haven't tried all the different things, and so we shouldn't make strong claims.
Okay.
Great. So yeah, I won't be making any strong claims. Okay, why do we care about the spectral instability, right? So because the quasi-normal frequencies, they might be drastically different from the clean ones, right? And that would affect our observations, right? And it also shows you the importance of time domain verification of results that you computed in the frequency domain. Because from what we found, the fundamental frequency, although it follows although the dirty spectrum in the frequency domain is very different, but in the time domain, we don't really see it. So if you have your favorite theory or favorite modification of GR, you computed the frequencies, then perhaps you should also do this time domain verification and see if you can see those frequencies in the spectrum, in the time domain. And also, this actually motivates an agnostic mode search procedure. So perhaps we shouldn't assume that any of the frequencies are there because maybe this instability will affect the frequencies. And perhaps we should use a frequency agnostic procedure, and I'll show later. Okay, so I said that the black hole ring diet is nonlinear, right? Now, there are actually a lot of work on this already. So, for example, there are nonlinear quasi-normal modes. This is the thing I'll be talking about. There was tentative evidence by Lionel London a few years ago, a lot of years ago, actually. Zijeng found these quadratic modes with Eve, and this independent with the work that I'll show you later. And there are also other nonlinearities like turbulent black holes that we're studying and absorption-induced excitation that Will, Lewis, Lara have been working on. Also, there's gravitational wave memory. So the nonlinearities I'll be talking about are not the only type of nonlinearities. So I think I'm a little running short of time, so I'll go very quickly here. If we have the Tukulsky operator and you want to solve the second order one, right? Then you simply put the first order solution as the source term. You square the first order solution and put it in the source term, and then you solve the same equation, right? If you square the first order solution and the first order solution is a quasi-normal mode, then you get squared of the amplitude, 2 times the frequency, 2 times the phase, right? And then you plug this in back into the source term. And you solve this with homogeneous and particular solution, right? Homogeneous solution is just the first order solution because the Tukulsky operator, the homogeneous solution is just the quasi-normal mode. And then the particular solution, you can write an ansatz that looks, again, like a quasi-normal mode. And then you can match the particular solution with the source term, and you'll find that the second order quasi-normal mode should be 2 times the frequency of the first order one. Amplitude should be squared. Phase should be 2 times, right? But in general, So this particular solution is the second order quasi-normal mode. In general, you can have two different linear modes coupling and talking to each other, and then they will source quadratic modes, which we will denote by like a times multiplication symbol, and they are the sum of the frequencies. The amplitude are proportional to the multiplication of the linear amplitudes, and the phase is an addition of the linear phase. Okay. Now, if we plot the quadratic modes in the complex plane, for example, the 220 and 330 modes, like in some of the binary black hole mergers, they are the most important two modes, right? So these two modes can talk to each other, and they will source this second order quasi-normal mode. So this 220 times 220 is just the double of the 220, right? So this is the origin, so this is just the double. Right? 220 times 330 is just 220 plus 330. And you can see that they lie pretty much away from the overtones and the fundamental mode, so we might be able to find them in simulations, right? So we try to use two different sets of simulations. Firstly, head-on simulations. They look like this. We use the Geochambeau code. And quasi-circular mergers. So we use the SXS simulation catalog, right? And then we try to look for these quadratic modes inside of these waveforms. So for example, here I show you the results for the head-on collision. And the two of the black holes, like the two black holes that are merging head-on, had an initial boost of Lorentz factor gamma is equal to 2. So there's pretty fast black holes. Right? They are colliding pretty quickly. And then we found a lot of linear modes. So we include them in our fit model. So gamma is the initial boost. And then these linear modes, we see them inside of the waveform because of mode mixing and because they exist. And we include them in a fit model with only a free amplitude and a free phase. The frequencies we fix to the theoretical values because we already confidently identified them with other procedures that I don't show here. And then if we add another free mode on top, by a free mode, I mean a mode in the model where all of these parameters are free, so the frequencies are also free. And then we fit the waveform starting later and later from 0 to 50 m, actually to, yeah, here I only show from 5 to 20. And you can see that the free mode actually approaches this 200 times 200 mode, which is like the quadratic of this one, right? So this is only for gamma equals 2. If we change the initial boost, then you find that all the other simulations give similar results that surround this 200 times 200 mode. And if you look for the time at which this free mode approaches best the quadratic mode frequency, so these we call the optimal times. So this is the error of the fit when compared to the actual 200 times 200. You look at the neighborhood of this time, then you see that the amplitude and the phases, they are both pretty flat. Okay. So we might be onto something. Okay.
So sorry, can you explain that to your statement? When you point at a specific time down there, or?
Yes. So this time here, like this circle, right? For example, for the highlighted simulation, this is the time t equals around 17 m. That corresponds to when the frequency is closest to the one we expect to find.
Right.
And then here we look at the neighborhood of this point. So we shift this point to t optimal. Yes. And then we see that the amplitude is more or less flat. I agree that it's not too flat, so we need to do other tests. Also, phase is also more or less.
Sorry, what are all the other curves in the top diagram?
So these are the curves that I obtain when I look at simulations with other gammas. So other initial boosts. So they're colliding faster and faster.
But the more or less flat got something to do with the
CPU. Yes, of course. They're only flat by eye. Yeah. And these head-on simulations are not super clean, so we expect some fluctuation. But then we do other tests later, and I'll show you. Yes.
It also seems like the frequency fit is not very flat, right?
What do you mean by flat? Like constant?
At this point that you're thinking like that?
Yes. I agree. We need better simulations to find a better result. But I'll show you more plots and see if you're convinced that this is actually what we found. Okay. Okay. Yeah, sure. So this is the head-on merger case. And then there are also the quasi-circular merger case, right? So for the quasi-circular mergers, these are like the realistic events that we could perhaps see. Right? This time, we tried to look for the 2 to 0 times 2 to 0 mode. And you can see that when we fix the 4-4 mode inside of the LM equals 4-4 harmonic, and we find the 2 to 0. By the way, these modes are expected to be found in the 4-4 because of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. So if you sum two modes, then how does it project onto the spherical harmonics? Right? You sum, so you look at the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, and you find that they will exist in the LM equals 4-4. Okay. And same thing, we look for the optimal time. The amplitude is more or less flat. Phase more or less flat. I know this, okay, this is in linear scale, so it should be a little flatter than it seems. And then also for the 2 to 0 times free free 0 mode, we found mostly the same thing. However, I agree, amplitude might not be too flat, so let's do more tests. Okay. Now, it's like this is only not only about the frequency, right? The amplitude should also scale in a quadratic manner, right? If this quadratic mode is sourced by linear modes, then the dependence should look like this, right? And that indeed is the relationship we found. So if we look at all the simulations with different boosts, then they will have different amplitudes in the modes, right? And when the amplitudes are different in the linear modes, the quadratic amplitude should also scale the same way in a squared manner, right? So here there's a log-log plot, and we fit a straight line, and the slope is around 2. So this is when we think we have found the quadratic modes.
Do you have any value for even higher boosts? Do you expect this to continue at some point?
So it's painfully difficult to obtain the results for 3.2. We tried, not me, but like the people running the simulations, like Thomas Helfer and Case Wang. They tried the gamma equals 5. That's speed equals like 0.995 speed of light, and it's very difficult to obtain clean results. Okay, so these are only the head-on mergers, right? And then this is like for the other another mode, 200 times 400, same thing. And then for the quasi-circular mergers, same thing. We find the quadratic dependence. And also for the phase, the phase of the quadratic mode is the sum of the phases of the linear modes, right? This is very clean, okay? So this is not as clean because like in the SXS catalogs, this is the 200 times 200 mode. Because in the SXS catalog, no matter how you vary the initial conditions, the amplitude doesn't change too much, so you can't really see like a very huge range for your thing. But still, it's consistent. Why do we care, right? So firstly, nonlinearities are important. Okay. Now, this is also a new way to test GR, right? Because do these nonlinear modes exist, right? Maybe this requires next generation detectors, and this is what I've been looking at with another student, Sophia Yi. And if these are identified, do their amplitude and phases follow the expected relationship? Because although the dependence is quadratic, right, we didn't say anything about the coefficients. Now, the coefficients, in principle, you can calculate from GR, right? These will be dependent on the spin, perhaps, but it also could depend on the theory of gravity. Okay, so you can test GR with these. Okay, now I will speed run through the final section. Now, I think the main thing that we want to do here is to see if we can have a robust procedure for extracting quasi-normal modes. And we think that we have found a procedure that at least satisfies us. And we actually published this 2 weeks ago on Archive. So how could we extract a quasi-normal mode? Firstly, I think we should ask, is the frequency present? Or is the frequency of the mode the best fit frequency? So in the plot I showed just now, we have, like in the model, we have quasi-normal modes with free frequencies that we did not fix, right? So do they actually go to the frequency that you want to look for? That should be the first question that we ask, in my opinion. Second question, are the amplitude and the phases constant, right? Just as we discussed before. And finally, do we see the mode in a long enough time window? So is this constancy or is this frequency found within a long time window or short time window? Is it only 1M or 10M or 20M, right? These are all important. And in fact, I wrote a Python package to do all of this. It's called Jacqueline. Okay? It's Jax because maybe you've heard of the Google package Jax, quasi normal something, linear something. You decide. OK, firstly, is the frequency present, right? If we use a model for which we do not fix the frequency of the mode and we only include one of these modes in the model, then when you fit later and later, you see that the frequency goes to the fundamental mode frequency as expected. Great, right? This mode should be there. And then if we know that the fundamental mode is there, we can fix its frequency in the model. And then we add on top of that another free quasi-normal mode. And you'll find that it actually kind of flirts with the 2-to-1, and then it goes away. Okay. So at the intermediate time, it seems to see the 2-to-1, but then it tries to go away. So perhaps maybe there are other modes here that we didn't take into account, right? So let's be ambitious and burn our laptops by including 10 of these free quasi-normal modes. Okay. So these are 40 parameters. All the frequencies are free. All the amplitude and phases are free. And then you see that you find a lot of different modes. So firstly, the modes that we expect to find, 2-to-0, 2-to-1, great. And then there is this mode called the retrograde mode. So this mode is actually a mode that is counter-rotating to the Kerr remnant. Okay. Because when you have a binary black hole merger, the orbital direction most likely is aligns with the final remnant, unless you have like progenitors that are spinning anti-aligned to the orbit in the first place. So unless that's the case, the prograde modes that are orbiting, like co-rotating with the Kerr remnant, they should be dominant. But then we still find the retrograde mode. And then there are also other modes that come because of mode mixing. I don't really have time to talk about them, but they are also there. Yeah.
Why do you choose your interpretations for frequency?
So for this particular simulation, we are using the SXS catalog simulations. We didn't do any of the simulations. We pick this one because this one is the one that mimics GW150914. Yeah. So this is like almost equal mass non-precessing waveform. Okay. So there's also the memory effect. We found it through the constant. Yeah. These I really don't have time to discuss. So given that we found all these modes, like we're using a lot of parameters, perhaps we're overfitting, right? So we need to check the amplitude and the phase. Right, and see if it's constant. If we use all of the modes that we found just now, it's a complete mess. Right. So let's remove the mode that is varying the most. Okay. If we remove the mode that is varying the most, so the R320, the retrograde 320, improves a bit. We remove the one that varies the most, improves a bit, improves a bit, improves a bit, until when all of the modes meet one of the predetermined tolerances that we impose. It's something like the modes varying, the amplitude and phases varying less than 20%. Okay, and then we say, okay, these are the modes that we confidently see. Okay.
Sorry, what do you mean by removing?
Removing means like we use a model where we do not include that mode. Okay. So here we fix all the frequencies. So here we include like 10 modes, and then we only include 9 here, 8 here, 7 here, 6.
So you're fixing the frequencies. Your amplitudes are free.
Yes. Yes.
So you are including less in your fewer models in your fewer modes in your model.
Yes.
So you just have a statistic reference for whatever simpler model, but how am I supposed to understand this?
So when the amplitude is varying, we know that perhaps there's overfitting. So we shouldn't say that this model is confidently working. So that's why we remove the mode with the amplitude that is varying the most and see whether it works better.
Okay.
It does. It works better, 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 until we can confidently say, OK, all of these modes we see here are confidently present. And that's when we terminate the algorithm and we say these modes are actually there.
Yeah, how do you say that you're confident that they're there?
Okay, it's a tolerance that is predetermined. So it's something like a number 20%. So maybe here it's varying like 25%. Here it like one of the modes is varying to like something like 25%. We remove it, and then now this is within tolerance, within 20%.
Okay, but is it that odd number that you chose because you feel?
It's okay. Yes, this is pretty arbitrary. Okay, so there is some arbitrariness in our algorithm.
But the phi still vary a lot, right? Even at last.
Yeah. So this one we take like 20% of 2 pi, something like that. So. It looks like it varies a lot, but the algorithm doesn't lie, I guess. So it only keeps it when it thinks it's below the tolerance.
So for example, the green line is not a constant, is it?
Oh, okay. Yes. It has to be constant within a time window, like within a t equals 10m time window, something like that. Yeah. So here it's constant.
Okay.
So if you can arrive at the same tolerance with omega r that is different from the fundamental values. If you can arrive at this, what is this? How can I understand anything from this figure?
So here, you know that these modes with those frequencies have this amplitude which is constant, and this amplitude which is constant, and this phase which is constant. And when you know that it has this frequency, this amplitude, and this phase, it is a constant normal mode.
Yeah, but like if you leave omega I and omega r as a free parameter, you can arrive at the same uncertainties in the fitting. Then your omega I and omega r is going to be different from the fundamental. So your metric is not telling me anything about the physics.
Why is that the case? Can you say that again?
So if you leave omega I and omega r as a free parameter,
yes,
you would arrive at this at different points in omega I and omega r that is not fundamental modes or higher tones. And then if you arrive at the same uncertainties there, this means that your uncertainty metric is not telling me anything for the physics.
But here the fits do converge, like kind of converge, to like different fundamental modes. So the frequency actually makes sense here. And then,
sometimes,
you're right. But here, again, I use a tolerance, right? Like, it has to, for example, it has to go within this gray ellipse for at least t equals 10m, something like that. And then we say, okay, maybe we found this. And then we do additional tests. Okay, even the amplitude is constant,
right?
All four numbers are good. That's a quasi-normal mode. That is our philosophy. But I need to clarify that this is, to be honest, a pretty difficult problem because these are exponentially decaying and the amplitudes of these are like very small. So perhaps some other method has to be used to check our results.
So Eric has a question.
Yes? Eric?
Yes, you mentioned that you're using a tolerance of 20%. Does that mean your method gives results only to an accuracy of 20%?
In the amplitude, yes. And if you want to use another tolerance, you can use my code, change the number. It's very easy to do it. It's a Python package.
But you want to get a result for mass and spin of the black hole or something. And don't you want to make that as good as possible? I mean, if you say, oh, the black hole has a mass of plus minus 20% and a spin, but that's not.
So this is not the mass and the spin. This is the amplitude and the phase. And in general, the amplitude and the phase cannot be found too accurately. And this, like, although 20% sounds large, firstly, these are the tolerance for the subdominant modes, right? Although the tolerance for the dominant modes are the same, like if below 20%, then we keep it. However, the dominant modes, most likely, their biases are less than 20%. It's just that the subdominant modes are biased in 20%. And in actual data analysis, we don't really care about these subdominant modes because here we are looking at waveforms that are extracted at a certain spherical harmonic. So anyways, so.
Well, what's the accuracy that you're getting for mass and spin? Are you fitting these as well? Or do you assume you know them ahead of time?
Yeah, I assume I know the mass and spin ahead of time. So here, I'm trying to do like the most optimistic procedure for me to extract everything that I want to know from NR simulations. So if I already know the mass and the spin, I fix it.
Yeah.
Actually, we found pretty solid evidence of overtones in this case. So if you remove overtones, maybe you can push that, you know, constant.
I would say that there has to be a tolerance in the time for which you consider it flat. It again depends on your tolerance.
Yeah.
But of course, I'll be happy if you found overtones. Yeah, can't wait to see the paper. Okay. And then in the end, once we discarded all the modes that are unstable, we can try to extract the amplitude and the phase of these modes. Okay. So here I highlighted the regions for which the amplitude and phases are the flattest, and then I extract the amplitude and phase from there, and then the fluctuation gives me sort of error bars. Okay. So this whole procedure is like we wrote a Python package for it.
Okay.
And you can also see our recent paper on this. So for all of the SXS simulations that are non-precessing, like all the non-precessing SXS simulations, they are parameterized by three parameters in the initial conditions, right? The mass ratio, this is the symmetric mass ratio eta, and then the two spins. But these are just like this chi effective, basically. There's a weighted sum of the spins, there's the weighted difference of the spins. And then so we can map the amplitude of each of the modes like from this 3D initial condition domain, right? So on each of these, So each of these points is one simulation in the SXS catalog, and then we extract the amplitude of one of the modes. And if you want to look at the results for all the other modes, you can go to our website, and we have interactive plots. You can drag the 3D plots along. Yeah. Spent a lot of time making those plots, so I appreciate if you go take a look. Yeah. Okay. So, but then here we have a model, right? If you give me the simulation parameters, non-precessing, then I can give you the amplitude of the modes. And we also have fits for this, like we have polynomial fits of this, and it's on our paper. Now, we can revisit the quadratic modes that we extracted, which just now I showed you that if I look at a few simulations, there is the quadratic dependence on the amplitude and phase. Here we verify the relationship again, but this time because we're not only picking the simulations where we extracted the amplitudes confidently, we find all of the simulations for which we think we found the amplitude, and so there is a higher spread in the these plots of the these plots are the dependence of the quadratic amplitude to the linear amplitudes and the quadratic phase to the linear phase, but still they more or less follow the dashed lines. So the outliers are because some of our results are biased, because sometimes we don't find all the modes that we have to find. Sometimes we include a mode that actually we shouldn't have included, but that is really up to our tolerance. And so again, this is inherently, in my opinion, a difficult problem. And if there are other algorithms to test our results, then that would be great. Okay, but still, like it's pretty, it looks pretty good, even after using all of the simulations. And then this plot, I think it's very interesting. Because here we are plotting the ratio between the overtone, right? 2-to-1 overtone and the 2-to-0 overtone, right? And then this x-axis here is the remnant spin, okay? So no matter what initial conditions we use, no matter if it's a big black hole, small black hole, large mass ratio, whatever, so this is the mass ratio, the color, we see that there seems to be a quasi-universal relationship, right? Quasi-universal, more or less universal, that you can fit the ratio of the overtones with. Now the 331 and 330 seems to have a larger spread, right? But perhaps here it really doesn't depend on initial conditions too much.
No.
Yeah.
Actually, it depends on the time, the reference time, right? Because they have even decarried.
So. I depends on the reference time, but we always extrapolate it back to the peak of the waveform. The peak doesn't mean anything. You're right. You're right. Yes.
You have many systems, and how do you peak the?
Yes. You're right. But I don't think there is a right way. Right. Yeah. So we do our best.
Yeah. So if you shift your reference time to 10 nanometer peak, I I think this pattern will change a lot. But
I see.
Because they have
it depends on only it depends only on chi remnant, because if you want to shift the time by 10 m,
right,
you put it. Does it depend?
You know, they decay differently.
I know. You're right. But at least in this case, we see quasi-universal
relationship.
Maybe after shifting, it still behaves like this. We need to see. You're right. Yeah. Okay. Finally, my penultimate slide. These are the retrograde modes. This is the excitation of the retrograde mode. So the mode that counter rotates with the Kerr remnant over the prograde mode, so the dominant one. And you can see that this is log scale and this is chi effective. So a higher chi effective means that the spins are more aligned with the orbit, and negative chi effective means that the spins are more negative, like more anti-aligned with the orbit. Right. And when chi effective is low, so more anti-alignment, then we see that the retrograde modes are excited more. And we found that these points in the log scale can be well fitted by a parabolic surface, more or less. Okay, so there are some deviations maybe here, but more or less makes like looks pretty smooth. And the same for 210 retrograde.
Okay.
So my
obtaining some dependency on the parameters.
So I think the most important message is that when the spins are more negatively aligned to the binary orbit, then the retrograde modes are excited more, right? So because if chi effective more negative,
sure,
higher.
I'm actually very interested in the second one, as you're saying, the lower which kind of excited.
This one.
There is a difference.
What difference?
Both ones, the retrograde and the prograde, if I wanted to kind of picture a mechanism by which I'm generating the overtones, it's telling you the mechanism is slightly different because there is a dependency. There is a dependency on the remnant finite spin. Just go to the next slide.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm looking at both overtones. So
the overtone?
Retrograde with the prograde overtones. Isn't that the right plot?
I won't consider this overtone because it's zero, so it's fundamental mode.
Okay, I'm reading it wrong. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, not my bad.
I see. Okay.
Doing the overtones, so you have overtones.
Okay, so they are not clean, the overtones. Yeah, because they decay very fast, and as you can see, there are a lot of modes in the waveform. This is tough. Yeah. Okay, so. Conclusions. I think, like in my opinion, a frequency agnostic fit with like an amplitude stability check could be a good strategy for extracting quasi normals. But again, we need more procedures to cross check. And the black hole spectrum is spectrally unstable, as I mentioned in the short interlude. And a rich spectrum of modes exists in the ring down for binary black hole mergers. There are fundamental modes, overtones, retrograde modes, and quadratic modes. Quasi universal. Relationships exist between modes, amplitudes, and I think this warrants further investigation. Perhaps this could be interesting to the theorists also. And we have a hypermodel for the fit amplitudes. So if you give me an initial condition for the binary black hole merger, then I can give you the amplitude. And this is all inside of the Jacqueline package. You can call these hypermodels. Like interpolation or like the polynomial fitting. And if you want to fit quasi-normals, look for Jacqueline. Okay? That's it.
Okay, so I think we're a bit over time and we have asked a lot of questions. So let's thank the speaker again, but then after that we can have offline discussion.